Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. And welcome back, everyone, to the second of our best bits from our ever-expanding vaults.
And waistlines.
Yeah, well, of course, especially, you know, I mean, with the fish and chips you keep forcing me to have on the seafront.
I didn't make you have the pickled egg.
Well, I'm not having the whelk anymore because that did played havoc.
It played havoc, didn't it?
And today we're going to concentrate on a selection of legends from the 60s. In fact, this episode is called Legends of the 60s. And we've had a few on, haven't we?
So coming up, we will be hearing from Colin Blunstone, Marianne Faithfull, Jerry Shirley from Humble Pie, legendary producer Shel Tamy, and something from the very first episode of Rockonteurs.
Yeah, welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
So first up, we've got Hank Marvin. Everybody, Guy, says that he's the guitarist's guitarist. He's their big influence, isn't it? I mean, so many of the people who we've interviewed.
When you first discovered rock and roll, though, weren't you surprised when you found that out? Because there were all the people you loved, like Mick Ronson and Pete, and they all go, yeah, this guy. And you look at this guy in the suit and glasses, and you go, really?
Yeah, because we're the next generation along,
exactly,
aren't
we?
But, you know, you remember Hank owned the first Stratocaster ever to come into the UK. Bought for him by Cliff
by
Richard.
Cliff. Yeah.
You know, and everyone forgets about Cliff as well, because, you know, we all see Cliff as being sort of light entertainment, but Cliff was the... You know, him and Tommy Steele were the first British rock and rollers.
That's right, absolutely. I mean, and the importance goes to things like Ed Bicknell, Dire Straits manager. He was told to go and see this band. He walked in and Mark Knopfler was playing a red Strat like Hank. And that's what made him decide to manage them.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about people who were influenced by him. You know, Brian May, Tony Iommi. I mean, John Lennon would have said it. George Harrison said it. I mean, Jeff Beck, Richie Blackmore, Mark. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, the other thing is when the Shadows started, it was a club in Soho called the Two Eyes.
That my dad painted the basement of with that's Lionel Bart.
That's amazing. I think I'd forgotten that. That is amazing. And did they play in the basement or did they play upstairs?
Yeah, no, they played in the basement with everyone sitting around with their coffees.
And the bouncer at the Two Eyes was who?
Peter Grant, Led Zeppelin's manager.
Yeah, famously aggressive, but
legendary. I bet he was a very efficient bouncer.
He was. So anyway, we have a clip here and I think it's actually talking about to Hank about how he influenced so many great guitarists. Every guitarist that's happened since the 60s and 70s, after you, everybody refers to you. And I mean everybody, yeah. The greats. I had a quick chat with Pete Townsend this week who said, just say to Hank, I love him, but he knows that.
Not to get competitive or anything, but I had a word with David Gilmour who said to send you his very best. And I did actually say, would you have a question? Firstly, he said what an incredible influence you were on him. He said he once asked you what delay unit you used and you couldn't remember.
If that's a question he once answered, and it depends which period he's talking about. The original
Yeah, the original Echo Box was marketed in the UK by Vox, but it was actually a Miarty Echo Box, which I understand, again, Miarty was simply the marketing retailer's name. It wasn't the name of the manufacturer. I'll tell you who introduced me to that box. Do you remember a really old guy called Joe Brown?
Yes.
Of course. And Sam, his daughter, was on tour with us.
And me.
You guy.
She toured with Pink Floyd. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Joe, I mean, he's a lovely guy, Joe. And we used to have a laugh together when we used to meet up from time to time. Back in 1959, we were appearing, you know, this was towards the very end of the variety days. So you still had a few variety theatres in operation, one of which was in Liverpool Empire. And we were doing a week there, Cliff and the Drifters, I think we were still called then, just before we changed our name. And Jack Good, who then was a TV producer and director, who did Oh Boy Show and Boy Meets Girl, he was doing Boy Meets Girl from Manchester. And he called Cliff up and said, look, we've got Gene Vincent on the show. Do you want to come over and meet him? So we all shot over there. And while we were sort of surrounding Gene Vincent in admiration, Joe Brown pulled me to one side. And he said, I want to show you something. And he showed me this. It was only about so big, so deep, a box with a few dials on the front, a couple of knobs. And he gave me his guitar and said, try this. And the first echo that it had on there was the typical rock and roll tape echo, which sounded amazing. You know, that's the echo you want to get on stage, you know, to sound like the old rock and roll record. So I was knocked out with that. Then I discovered very quickly that it had multi heads. So by depending which group of heads you chose and which speed, etc., you could get these tripping, tumbling echoes.
Right.
Like the Benson echo.
Yeah, well, that's right. The Benson was a later addition to the market. And I went on to Benson's for a while because the problem with this Vox was that it had a flat drum around which you put a quarter-inch tape, okay? So it's actually recording on the tape. But, of course, you had to splice the tape, and if the tape wasn't quite correctly spliced, you got to like... Plus... it was very noisy, incredibly noisy, you know, which you didn't hear when we were playing, but obviously a gap in the music when you're talking, you heard this sort of noise going on.
One thing is going back, as it's been a fantastic rabbit hole being down for the last week of going through all your stuff, is the sound of those records, right? Sonically, just in terms of recording and stuff, is so good. It's like they could have been recorded yesterday. When you compare what records went on to sound like in the 60s, just technically, they're amazing. They're so beautifully clean, and you know, the fidelity is fantastic. What do you put that down to?
Just probably drugs. No, we didn't touch that stuff. I'll tell you what, though, we had a great recording engineer, Malcolm Addy. Yeah. He was really good.
Is that Abbey Road?
Yes. Malcolm used to work a lot with Norrie Paramore, who's the record.
Norrie Paramore, right. Yeah.
And Malcolm was the engine. Then Peter, when Malcolm left and went to go to the, he had an offer in the States, so he went over to the USA. Peter Vince took over about 1964 or five, maybe. But Malcolm said something to me one day, which I thought was interesting. He said, I had a call from a producer. He's recording an instrumental and he wants to know how we get what he thinks is a big sound on your records. And he's using a lot of instruments, you know, like drums and percussion and keyboards and two or three guitars and so forth and so forth. And Malcolm said, one of the secrets is, quite honestly, he said, it's the small group. You can hear everything and it sounds bigger because you're hearing each instrument come through it. We never played too loud in the studio. Some of the early records, a couple of records, we sort of got into a slight bit of distortion. We did a thing called Shotgun, which was a little distorted. And Man of Mystery is definitely boring on that. But generally...
Because I often wondered about that, even with your early length, with your Little Selma. Did you not notice when you cranked it right up that it would distort? Did you not think, hang on?
It's quite a good sound. Let me come up with a riff.
Yes. Well,
The problem was in those days that if you did anything like that, and it was, yes, there might be a hint of distortion, but if it got into serious distortion, yeah, it would just say, whoa, what's wrong with the amp? You know, people didn't like it.
Yeah. But this, I think the sound, I think what Guy is talking about and the clarity and the beauty of it really is your guitar. Because if you try and listen to the backing track on those instrumentals, Apache or FBI, you know, they're quite condensed in a way, quite simple, but out front is this wonderful guitar sound. Now, you were playing on the famous Fender Strat, and we have to discuss this because this in history is so important. I mean, we all know David Gilmour plays a Fender Strat. He just sold it for, how much did he sell it for?
That was 3.6 million, but all the Pink Floyd tours I did, he was playing a red Strat.
But the Stratocaster is so important in the history of rock and roll. And, you know, obviously your inspiration to play this Stratocaster, to play one, was Buddy Holly. Tell me two things. Tell me about Buddy Holly and why he's so important in rock and roll and to you. And tell me, how did you end up with the first Stratocaster ever to come into Britain?
Yeah.
Okay, well, with Buddy, the first record I heard that I didn't even know who it was at the time was That'll Be the Day on a jukebox in Newcastle. And it just sounded incredible. You know, this mono sound, a lot of bottom end on it, and the guitar sounded so... That introduction was so fabulous. And Buddy had an unusual way of singing, didn't he? That little hiccuping style he had. Yeah. And that made a big impact. And then almost immediately, I wanted to hear what else he was doing. I loved the sound of his voice. I loved the guitar. Then I found out he wore glasses. And I thought, I hope he has acne, because then, you know, then we're pals. But anyway, I just thought he was sensational. You know, he came up with some good rock and roll songs. He had a good guitar sound. He had a distinctive voice. And I think he gave hope to guys like me who were skinny and wore glasses that you didn't have to look like Elvis Presley or...
But there's also... I want to get guitar nerdy here because there's a thing about the color, isn't it? Because it's supposedly Fiesta Red, but it wasn't known as Fiesta. It's the color was known as Salmon Pink over here. So what actually was it?
Well, for some reason, Bruce, Cliff, and myself, when we poured over the Fender catalogue, because just to a bit of explanation about that, you couldn't buy new American instruments in the UK in 1959. There was still an embargo on. That didn't get lifted, I think, till the end of 1960 or something.
Wow, I never knew that.
Yeah, what was that? I always wondered about that, which is why everyone tended to play German guitars, right? So everyone had Hofners, wasn't it? What was that embargo exactly?
You'd have to do some research. And once you find out, if you let
everyone... This is my research. I'm asking you.
it was some stupid embargo. But anyway, what happened, therefore, we had to send direct to the Fender factory and buy it direct. So we got the brochure and we looked through it, and the most expensive guitar was the Stratocaster. And we'd already seen a photograph of Buddy Holly, so we knew that. We didn't know what it was called, but that was the shape of the guitar he had. And we saw they had it in red with gold-plated hardware, bird's-eye maple neck, and a whammy, or they call it a vibrato bar. So, tremolo arm. It's a vibrato bar, really.
Yeah.
So that's what we ordered. And the color, we're all convinced, was down as flamingo pink. We have constantly heard from Fender there was never any such color. And I heard from some guy who was doing a book recently, sent me a lot of information, and he's traced it back, and it was some kind of red. That the color we think was pink was never apparently in their toolbox at the time. So it was some... I'll have to look it up.
So when this arrives, this box with this guitar in it, I mean, what an extraordinary thing to appear in the UK. Did people just gather? Did people come from miles around to stare at it?
They would have done if we let it out of our sight. The thing was, you can imagine opening the cardboard box, and then you've got this tweed flat.
Oh, yeah, so was it tweed? Oh,
you know, it's that tweed finish that we never see. And the flat case, we'd only ever seen guitar-shaped cases. Open it up, red plush, sort of velvet lining. And this guitar looked like it just came in from Mars or somewhere.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic sight. You know, they're so commonplace now, we don't, perhaps can't fully appreciate the impact that had in the flesh. Absolutely.
But they still look like the future. They still look like the future, the Stratocaster. It's an absolutely timeless.
And a very versatile instrument too. I'll tell you one thing though, I couldn't believe. The guitar prior to that was a little cheap Antoria with a neck that was actually curved. So the action got, as you got to about the fifth fret, it was getting higher and higher, then got lower and lower. But it did have a shorter scale than a, I probably had a Gibson scale, and you could actually bend the strings a little bit, the second string. In fact, in a couple of Cliff's early records, you can hear me bending quite easily. But with the Stratocaster, they were really heavy. And I found out later they came in with 13s to 56, like a 24 wound third.
Wow.
Well, that's where, you see, the whammy bar came in so useful, because I found that I could only bend the second string up like half step, but if I pulled the whammy bar, if I set it up correctly, I could pull up another half. Down, you know, give it a big pull up.
Right.
And not so much with the first string and a little bit with the third, but with that heavy third, you couldn't do much with it. And then, of course, you could dip the strings and you could get a lovely vibrato, make the guitar small, which was great.
And you found your voice. This was your voice now, Hank.
Yeah,
indeed it was. Indeed it was.
Now, the Zombies, that was a band that featured two great songwriters, Rod Argent and Chris White, and the fabulous vocals of one Colin Bluntstone.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted Colin on, didn't we? Because, I mean, there's some great vocals from Colin. I mean, I love that sort of high-end, syrupy voice of his, you know.
He was one of the first of the sort of choir boy singers, wasn't he, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I put David in that category.
They were a band from St. Albans, and obviously, you know, actually one of their songs gets played a lot by young kids nowadays. She's Not There.
Now, Gary, because you're a couple of years older than me, I'm wondering if I tell the truth, the first time I heard She's Not There, it was the Santana version, which was a hit single in the mid-70s.
Oh, wow. Well, I'd forgotten that. Yes, I think you're probably right. I'm hoping you're right. You are right, obviously.
I better be right or we're finished.
Well, She's Not... Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a Santana cover, yeah. In 1977 it came out on Moonflower album. And...
You're very quick on your Wikipedia.
I am. Must be, and of course, it was written by Rod Argent. I actually would love to get Rod on the show.
I agree. Can we say another little fact about the Zombies is how they actually managed to practically colonise Denmark Street. They all became very successful. You had Rod Argent's keyboards and Bob Henrit's drum shop.
Wow. Well, they were really entrepreneurial, weren't they?
Yes.
You know, if the records aren't selling, then let's sell instruments. That is amazing. But I mean, I was listening to Argent the other day, Hold Your Head Up. He's such a great
Russ God Ballard, gave rock and roll to you.
Russ Ballard, right, was a lead singer who's still around, and Rod's still around as well. I mean, both of them are people we'd love to get on this show, obviously.
So if they're listening.
But we were very happy to get Colin Bluntstone on. He was a beautiful man. I remember he's a really soulful guy, and it was a really nice episode.
This was one of those ones which is a really nice result where when we started the interview, Colin clearly had no idea what he was doing or who he was talking to, and then really, really warmed to it and really liked talking to us, which is a good feeling.
This clip is about Rod Argent being a great songwriter and their first trip to New York, and let's hear it.
The catalogue of songs that you have, you know, with your writing and the fact you had a band with two incredible writers in it. I was saying the last few days of being on a deep dive has just been delightful. I mean, just fantastic. Such beautiful records you've made.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Well, I think they were two really, for their age, I think they were quite sophisticated writers, actually. But and particularly Rod, I think. He just could always write songs. And I must admit, I didn't know until the band had been going for about 3 years, and we had a producer called Ken Jones. We won a rock and roll competition back in, well, it was in Watford, actually, next door to St. Albans, which led to a recording contract with Decca. And we were introduced to a producer called Ken Jones, and he was sort of saying, you know, we've got our first session in a couple of weeks' time. You could write something for that session if you wanted. Bands didn't do that in those days so much. Mm-hmm. You went to a songwriter. The Beatles changed all that, really. And I didn't think much on it. He went on to another subject then, but it clicked with Rod, and he went away and he wrote She's Not There, and brought it back about 48 hours later. And, you know, it was a million seller and went to number one in America. And in actual fact, he later told me that was the third song he'd ever written. He'd written a couple of songs, but he'd kept it a bit quiet. I didn't know anything about it.
How old was he?
when he wrote that, he was 18.
Oh, my God.
He wasn't like a trained pianist or anything, was he?
No, he wasn't, actually. I think he took about 2 years piano lessons when he was very young.
Yeah, I only say that because there was so much... I mean, years before everyone else, the stuff was musically so sophisticated straight out of the box. Everyone else was only doing 3-4 chords tops at the time. Mm. And you've already got like sneaks of this Baroque stuff. And,
he just was born with that. But also he was in the cathedral choir in St. Albans for many years.
Oh, there it is.
So
there it is.
He really understood harmony. And he's since taught himself to read music. And he made a wonderful classical album. If ever you get the chance to hear it, it's called Classically Speaking. He's playing major piano works, just fantastic.
But when Rod, when he speaks, he implies or he says that he would write out the bass parts, or he would write the bass parts. Does he mean actually write them out, or did he just sort of play them on the piano and show the other guys what to do?
There were times when he wrote parts out, but it wasn't always, I mean, especially not earlier on in the band. But it is interesting to me that when Rod wrote a song, he very often knew what the bass part should be. So he would explain it to Chris White, and he very often knew what the drum part should be. There's a very distinctive drum part in She's Not There, and also in Time of the Season. And he would always make a contribution, if not specify what the drums should be playing and what the bass should be, particularly the bass.
I was just saying, because like Time of the Season has, you mentioned the drum part, has that really particular, really brilliant stop-start rhythm thing with the vocal rhythm interjection as well.
I know, there's... Rob was talking about that the other day, and the big liberating force for us was at that time you could only record in this country on 4 tracks, but the Beach Boys had just done Pet Sounds and they had an 8-track machine in America, and John Lennon said to the engineers in Abbey Road, well, they've got an 8-track machine, we want an 8-track machine. The engineer said, there isn't one in the country, and he said, well, I don't know exactly what his words were, but he sort of said, this is your problem, not mine. Right. And he left them to it. And they managed to put 2 4-track machines together. I don't know the technical way that you do this. And in fact, that gives you 7 tracks. And so suddenly we were very used to recording on 4 tracks. So we would do the basic tracks and we had 3 tracks left. So we could double track harmonies or... Rod Argent, he said, you know, we've done Time of the Season. He said, you know, I can hear a little hand clap and gasp thing on this. And it was one take. He just went out there and went, dun, 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 all the way through it. And of course, it's a real hallmark of that.
Well, it's a hook. It's a hook. In yes.
Nowadays, yeah, you would sample one of those and just spin it all through, wouldn't you? And have it on cut and paste. But with She's Not There becoming such a big hit, I mean, suddenly this was... all at once, he was almost still at school. And the record is a bigger hit in America than the UK, I think, isn't it?
It is.
And you suddenly go off on some huge American tour. I mean, tell us a bit about that time and what your parents would have said.
It was really strange. If I just tell you very quickly about recording She's Not There. Oh, yeah. It was kind of fashionable to record in the evenings, maybe even going into the nights. So we'd arranged to start, well, our producer had arranged for us to start at 7 o'clock in the evening. And we arrived at Decca Studios in West Hampstead, a really, really good engineer. He recorded some wonderful stuff. But unfortunately, he'd been at a wedding all day and he was absolutely blind drunk. But worse than that, he was incredibly aggressive. And I can remember starting to sing. I've got the cans on, you know, and he's screaming down the cans at us, the worst language you can possibly think of. And taking into account, I've been in this business for about 60 years, I think, it makes me laugh because within 20 minutes of being in that studio, I knew the music business was not for me. I thought, this is never going to work with mad people like this. But on the evening, we had a little bit of luck because he passed out cold on the floor. He just fell on the floor and passed out. And we had to carry him out up 2 flights of stairs and we put him in a London black taxi. And I never saw him again after that. And his assistant engineer took over and that was Gus Dudgeon.
Oh, wow.
Gus Dudgeon, you know, recorded all the early Elton albums.
Yeah.
Kiki D, David Bowie, many, but that
big
was
producer.
His first session with the Zombies, and he never forgot that, and we never forgot it either. I mean, it was a miracle that She's Not There ever got recorded, to be honest. And it came out, and it was a hit pretty quickly in this country. It was helped because it was on Jukebox Jury, and that week, George Harrison was on the jury, And is it an old TV program? I don't know.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Pete Murray at the helm.
Yes. Or
was it? Was it? Have I got that wrong?
I can't remember. But anyway, George Harrison really liked it. And I can't really do a Liverpool accent, but he said, "Well done, zombies. That's the best I can do." And that's it. If he says that, it's a hit. And it was. And it wasn't a hit till quite a bit later in the States. It came out more in the autumn in the States. And it went to number one in Cashbox and sort of number two or three in Billboard. It was Christmas, 64, 65, that period. And we arrived there for our first live work, Christmas 64. There was a very influential DJ called Murray the K.
Murray the K.
Who considered himself to be the fifth Beatle.
I'm not quite sure
what the Beatles would say about that. But
I think he claims that Ringo or George named him the fifth Beatle.
That may be the case.
I thought Brian Epstein was the fifth Beatle anyway.
But anyway, he put these shows on. And so we opened at the Brooklyn Fox on Christmas Day with about 14 acts. And you just did one or two songs. And everybody played. And then, in theory, the audience is supposed to leave because there's eight performances a day, but mostly they just stayed there. There were queues around the block. It was very frenzied. So it was the Shangri-Las, the Shirelles, Benny King, Patti LaBelle, Dionne Warwick, Chuck Jackson, and many, many others. And
will you name check all this in your song, New York?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's line for line what happened, yeah.
Because you don't know exactly what's happening, but it's lovely, the specific... It reminds me of that Kate Bush song, Moments in Time. And it's a really lovely, evocative thing you do. But now you're giving us the actual diary entry that it is.
Yeah, I mean, there were all these thousands of kids outside, obviously. But and I hear a story that you went home on the subway.
We did. If I could just say, we had to follow Patti LaBelle, and then she had a singing group with her called the Bluebells. Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. And they bought the house down on every show. They were wonderful. And then these teenage kids from St. Albans had to slouch on stage after Patti LaBelle and play. I think we were a tad apprehensive, to be honest, but we got away with it. Let's put it like that. But going back to it was packed all around the Brooklyn Fox, and no one dared go out of the stage door. But on one occasion, our guitarist, Paul Atkinson, era of screaming people, and it could get quite scary. And Paul Atkinson went out of the stage door and he got caught by the crowd up against a plate glass window, and they tore his shirt off him. And the police came in and dragged him out. And they just said to him, "Look, we'll do this once, but we're not doing it again. So stay inside." So we would get there early and we would stay there all day with these crowds massing around. And then when the show ended, they all went home. We had no money, so we would just limp out of the stage door. There's no one there at this point, and we'd go home on the subway. And in those days, the Brooklyn subway was considered quite dangerous. And
absolutely.
People couldn't believe that we were going home on the Brooklyn subway. It seemed such a strange contrast from being kept, hidden away all day backstage because of this huge crowd outside.
Gary and I are used to the age of sort of the record company always having people on hand to sort of take you to and from.
But there was something of the, I don't mean this badly, but of the unglamorous about the zombies, that you just felt that,
a
couple of guys in glasses. And yet you were part of this first British invasion.
I know. We really suffered from that in the UK. And the trouble is that if I talk about it, which I'm obviously going to do, it reactivates that old image. It was also amateurish. We went to Decca Records one day to go to their press department. And remember, we were pretty much just out of school. One of the guys was literally just out of school. And we had a sort of a 20-minute, half-an-hour meeting with them. And it went something like, "Well, what are we going to do about an image for you?" It's really blunt and full-on like that. And we go, "Well, don't know really." And they said, "Well, what have you been doing?" Somebody came up with the idea of saying, "Well, literally, we've just got out of school." I really wish they hadn't said that, because the conversation then went on something like about, "Well, what did you do at school? You got lots of exams." We didn't get lots of exams. We got one or two exams. And we were launched as a sort of an English geek boffin band or something. Like that. And on top of that, of course, two of the guys had glasses. Chris White still has glasses, but Paul Atkinson, sadly, no longer with us, but he got rid of his glasses after a while. And to be honest, when he got contact lenses, he was a bit of a babe magnet. He was a good-looking boy. But those early photos that, and that image just destroyed us. I mean, we were just like any other young band, you know, but we missed out on Latin America because we went there 6 months after we'd made our first record, and they forgot about all that because we got a big hit record and we were treated in a different way in America.
We were fortunate enough to get Marianne Faithfull on the show, but it was the strangest of all the shows I remember recording, in that it was on Zoom, but you were actually at Marianne's house, weren't you, Guy? And you were sitting next to her, because I think it was quite an extraordinary moment that was about to happen in her life.
Yeah, I did, because she'd been very, very ill. It was amazing that she agreed to do it. And it was, I kind of went and sat with her and did it. And it was just, it was very special, that one.
But she was about to leave her house, wasn't she, as well?
That's right, yeah. And she's now in, I'd forgotten that, actually.
And she's now in Denville Hall, right?
Yeah, which is the very, very lovely actor's home, I must say. And I enjoy going up to see her there.
But I remember during this actual episode, I think she got very tired and it was cut short. But while she was on, it was a real thrill to talk to someone who's, you know, really had been there in the 60s when all those moments were happening. In fact, what a great story when we had Andrew Lou Goldham on, and Andrew talks about when he first goes to that party and he sees this incredible looking woman sitting on the radiator.
Yeah.
And he approached her and he heard her talking voice and he just thought, we've got to write you a song.
Yeah, because, I mean, Andrew and Marianne, you want to talk people who are in the room where it happened. I mean, come on.
You and Anita, were that was an amazing scene. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what a friendship. I mean, how did you meet?
I think we met in Rome. In those days, in the early days, Mick and Keith were really tight.
As in good
Keith
friends.
Wanted Mick to go to Rome. He did, you know.
Oh, that's nice.
What?
That's nice.
Yeah.
And so what year would that have been?
Oh, God. 66?
Oh, between 66. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And she was going out with Brian at the time, or was she? Okay.
When I first met her, yes, she was going out with Brian. But then I was with them, and so was Mick. We were in Tangier. And Brian used to beat her up. And... Wow. And Anita used to beat him up back, actually. But I guess I wasn't in the room when it happened. Christopher Gibbs and Mick and me, Christopher said, get out of here. This is not a good scene. And he was right, because the tension in the room with Brian, Keith, Anita, and poor Michael Cooper got so bad. And in the end, Keith is very romantic, of course. Keith just grabbed Anita and took her away. Wow. And they got into his Bentley and drove off, leaving Brian in bits, of course.
And of course, then Anita came between Mick and Keith because of performance when she appeared in that.
Yeah.
But was it, as an actor yourself, did you ever, were you a little bit, that should have been my part?
Glad it wasn't.
Yeah.
Because you were really a stage performer, weren't you?
Well, yeah. Yeah. All these things you're saying about my life and my work are really more applicable to Anita than to me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Really?
Could you explain that a bit?
Well, to her, what happened, if it was real and wasn't on the stage, was much more important. Do you understand?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I find it very hard to describe.
But her life was very dramatic.
It was, and very important to her. You know?
And was that whole Rolling Stone circle, was it something that was felt like almost a distraction for you at times?
Well, yes, of course it did. I couldn't really work at all. And it wasn't enough for me just to live life, I'm afraid.
Were you, was that partly, did Mick not want you to work? Or
no, he was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't want the
Keith didn't like her to work.
Oh, that's interesting.
Can you take this off for me?
Yes.
Because I'm getting hot.
Let us know if you get tired, Marianne.
No, it's not me, really. It's my throat, my lungs.
And has it been like that since you came out from COVID?
COVID, yeah.
Ugh. Have you been vaccinated now? I take
it. Oh, yes, twice.
Oh, good. I mean, you know,
I had a natural flow test this morning before I came here.
Oh, God.
Guy, we can't help be fascinated by those times. And in a way, those times, and I can see why I think you're drawn to the Romantic poets, Marianne, because they had a similar, there was a similar.
They were a much earlier version of
her. Yeah, yeah.
Well, also, I always thought there was a thing about that whole 60s world where, with the whole rock and roll thing, was basically you had a load of working class kids being able to behave the way those sort of upper class characters had all along, like back in the 18th century. It was to basically take drugs century. Like Byron or, you know.
That's 19th
century.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. But did you, you grew up in a commune, though, didn't you? Is that
true? I went to school in a convent.
In a commune.
Oh, right.
Which is kind
my
of
my father. Yes,
but that's before, because communes is something we associate with that whole 60s.
It's nothing.
Kind of world,
it wasn't
yeah.
a 60s commune.
Yeah,
it was a 40s commune.
What is it? What was it like?
It was like one of the bad things that happened after COVID is my lungs, my memory, and tiredness. These are the three things that really affect me, and it's an awful drug. I can't remember her name. It's a writer from the 40s, but it really was like a 40s commune. It was a school for integrative social research.
That sounds...
It doesn't sound like a 60s commune. No,
but were they trying, you know, I see what it was like for people to live together in one place as opposed
yeah.
to conventional
life. Right on.
But was it family units?
No.
It wasn't.
Oh, no.
Oh.
It was anybody.
Was there a free love about it?
No, none. I mean, there might have been. I was really little, you know, I was like six or something.
Yeah. But no, it's interesting, though, that you started off in what isn't a conventional way. And
oh, no, no, it wasn't.
And
my mother didn't like it.
Right. She was a ballet dancer, was she not?
She was a dancer, both kinds. She was in the corps de ballet of Max Reinhardt. And then after the ballet finished, she went on with her partner, Haider, and they played cabaret. Huh. So she did two kinds of dances.
Highbrow and lowbrow.
Yes.
You certainly inherited that then, haven't you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I was never snobby, you know. I don't buy all that. When you were talking about upper class, working class.
Yeah.
I never bought into that.
No, but that's what the 60s was
I know.
About. Was
and I think Anita understood
yeah.
all that,
yeah.
too. But I didn't care.
And it was because there was a reason why a lot of those guys in the art, like Bailey and Kane and Jagger, called themselves by their first names, because it was a sort of, it was like upper class people did, because before then, working class people were just called Alf. You know?
I don't know.
But I mean, listen, you're in this amazing scene with the Indigo Gallery and
yeah,
how I mean that to us is that's just the
that was really fascinating.
Yeah,
yeah, and watching Yoko and John fall in love, that was really fascinating.
But yeah, because your husband introduced them, didn't he, at the time?
He did introduce them, yeah.
And in the fullness of time, do you think that was a wise move?
Yes, I do. I really like Yoko. I like her a lot. She's been terribly kind to me.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Do you stay in touch?
A bit, yeah. I'm not really very social at all anymore.
I think what we probably want to know, guys, well, is you this, what, you know, you were beginning, you were an actor, maybe, you know, you're married to this important gallery person, and yeah. then you meet Mick. And, you know, I know...
My life turned upside down for 4 years. It was only 4 years. I'm glad. I mean, I don't regret it.
Yeah.
But it was difficult.
It's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
But that thing of just being at the absolute epicenter of, you know, swinging London. Because you,
well, I never realised
that.
What
were you doing before? You'd been singing in sort of folk clubs before you went to the momentous party where you
yeah.
met Andrew.
The House of the Rising Sun.
Tell me, I don't know about the meeting of Andrew.
It was a party. It was Adrian Poster's launching party. And I went with John and Peter Asher, actually. And there at the party was Andrew Oldham, Mick and Keith, and probably Brian. I don't remember.
And apart from that, was it a good party?
It was all right, yeah. What I was really interested in, because I was really hungry, was the food. It was great food.
Yeah, of course, you forget that when you're a young starving artist.
Yeah.
Actually, food features quite heavily.
So really good.
That was a gig. It was great. There was tons of sandwiches backstage.
Yeah.
They wrote their first song, did they? Didn't Andrew lock them in a room, Mick and Keith, and said,
yeah.
Tears go by.
Well, that's the song they wrote when they were locked in the room, yeah.
Was it meant to be for you from the start, or was it for them?
You know, musicians always do that. You know, this one's for you, baby. When they want to seduce you.
So I've got a song.
Yeah. And, of course, you told me it was for me, and I've always believed that.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know.
It's a strange song.
In that case, you are responsible for the Jagger Richards songwriting partnership.
No.
Well, if you think about it, that's the first song they wrote. You started this.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew needed a song.
Yeah.
For me. That's all.
Well, then you did.
Oh
my God. Don't bother me.
So after this ad break, we've got Nick Mason, Jerry Shirley from Humble Pie, and so much more, and the legendary producer Shel Talmy.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Next, we're going to go right back to the very beginning of Rock on Tours, episode one. And this is where our mad idea, which came up on the tour bus somewhere in Europe with The Source Full of Secrets. Now, Gary, you think it was actually Lee's idea, don't you?
I don't know. I don't know why you said that, because my mind changes every 5 minutes, as you know. I'm skittish and...
So skittish, like a cult. Like a baby foal.
But I do remember it as being your idea now. I don't know why you said Lee. I remember...
Maybe this is a compulsory thing we have, that everything ever was Lee's idea.
No, I do remember saying, you know, this sort of idea of like you two get a podcast, you know, because well, we've just spoke about...
just get a room.
Rock history the
whole
time.
Which we have.
We have. And I'm glad we were persuaded into doing it, because, I mean, this has been such a trip, you know, such a great thing to do, to talk to so many of what are essentially our heroes over the years. There's some nice clips coming up. We've got Nick Mason, we've got Jerry Shirley from Humble Pie coming up soon. And, you know, Jerry Shirley was someone, you know, I mean, that Rock in the Fillmore album, totally formative and so important to me.
You know, we have various touchstones, don't we? Things that keep coming up, which we then, like the screen on the green, which we then manifest. But I would say that Rock in the Fillmore is one of the absolute touchstones of Rock on Tours, because we come back to it so many times.
Yeah, and Peter Frampton was on an earlier episode as well, of course, and he spoke a lot about that. And then later on, we've got Shel Talmy, some clips from Shel on, who produced those incredible early Who records.
Yeah.
So here is a clip from the very first Nick Mason interview that we did, and we were just newbies, weren't we?
Do you know what, Gary, from listening to the clips from the last one, it was interesting listening to Phil Manzanero, how on those early ones, just how much we had to learn, because everyone's talking over each other a lot.
Yeah, of course. We now do that all the time still.
Yeah.
But no, we were newbies. And I think I remember even having my crib sheet and my questionnaire all sort of written out in front of me, terrified.
I thought you were just in your crib.
Anyway, let's go to our very first episode. And this is Nick Mason talking about those early days with Sid and the UFO Club.
Because the first thing we did was Interstellar Overdrive, wasn't it?
was it?
I think it was.
Wow.
Once we'd done the kind of 4-6, whatever, however many times around the riff, and then it goes into the sort of improvised bit, what did we do?
Yeah, because the weird thing about it on the record is it's completely atonal. I think what we did is we listened to a lot of versions, didn't we? We listened to a live version, various live versions from back in the 60s, and we were really fascinated by this atonal breakdown. I mean, how wild was that back in the 60s to do that sort of stuff? Who were you copying?
It was jazz, wasn't it?
It was. I don't know if it was you, but someone said was a great comment about that was how, because it's the same format as a jazz song where you do like sort of 16 bars or something, and then everyone solos, and then you do 16 bars riff, and then you're out.
But this is everyone soloing in a different key.
I think it was you who said, no, I know, but it was, whereas the jazz musicians used to do that because it was a great way to express what fantastic musicians they were, whereas with the early Pink Floyd, it was just showing quite the opposite.
Yeah. But where did you get into all that kind of atonal stuff, and how did...
I think that must have been Sid, actually. Sid. Who originally did the sort of breakdown of the concept. Because you're right, in a way, looking back to 1967, apart from a few really curious sort of singles, everyone was still working on this 2.5-3 minute piece length for any song in order to get radio play. So this sudden change into something completely different, which probably came from, was probably... directed by being in playing places like UFO and those sort of underground where clubs or venues where people expected something
different. Sorry, a club on Tottenham Court Road, wasn't it, back in the 1960s, run by Joe Boyd.
And Hoppy, John Hopkins.
So it was interesting for us to do that as a first number, wasn't it? Because it gave us the freedom in that middle section, the whole breakdown of weird stuff, of exploring what we could do and not feeling tied to the original records, you know, and coming up with our own stuff with echo units and delays. And I think that was actually kind of set us free right from the get-go, wasn't it?
The funny thing is, of course, now it's become much more... I think we basically have a middle section that's based on sort of three bits of three different live versions. You have a bit of a structure because you have to. Yeah. But it's also now a springboard for musical gags about either someone who's in the audience or the town that we're in.
I think
so something to look out for, trivia fans, if you're at a gig.
I think the most precious thing, really, was doing Sid, really, and singing his songs. That was... There's such a following out there for Sid, and you know, myth and legend that's built around him. And I almost can't believe you actually sat in the room with him. You know, it's almost like he didn't exist. I mean, the first time I ever heard a Sid song was, I'd say, it was David Bowie doing See Emily Play. You know, that was my version, you know, and in a way, Bowie was a kind of my way into singing Sid, you know, because he was a... He was so influenced by him. Just tell us a bit about him. What was he like? And when you...
Well, I of all the band, I think I probably knew Sid the least because Roger, in particular, had known Sid in Cambridge and had more or less grown up with him. And the same with David.
Was he scary?
No, absolutely not. He was absolutely delightful. The problem was that over a period of a year, he became less and less in charge of himself, I suppose. I mean, there is still no clear understanding of what went wrong or what happened. And I think there are two or three things that may be combined. Almost certainly there was an LSD problem in which he had bad trips, and instead of thinking this isn't working for me, he carried on trying for a breakthrough.
Well, David said that he was spiked a lot.
Well, he might have been,
you know, because there was a whole people wanted, because there was
disciples.
There was a whole thing of madness. But the whole R.D. Lang thing at the time, the whole ethos of madness was very fashionable, and people kind of liked the idea of sending Sid a bit mad. And that, you know, we're talking about kids. Everyone was kids, right? Yeah. And just not knowing what they were playing with.
Well, that's highly possible, and there's now belief that there was a particular version of LSD called STP, which was 10 times stronger than a regular dose.
This is a
new one that the info was sent to me by Jenny Spires, I think,
who was an ex-girlfriend of Sid's.
Yeah, within the last 2 years. So that's another element to the story. But the other thing is, which was the Ronnie Lang thing, Roger went to see him to talk about Sid, and apparently...
He was a psychotherapist, right?
Yeah.
Well, he went to see Artie Lang?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And talked to him about Sid, and apparently Ronnie Lang said to Roger, well, you know, maybe he's not the mad one. Maybe you are. Meaning that actually...
actually,
60s. Sid had maybe worked out that he really didn't want to be in a band and go on the road. He wanted to be a painter, which is what he'd originally come to London to do. And we, of course, thought that anyone who didn't want to be in a band was clearly insane.
Well, yeah, I remember you saying that because, of course, the whole concept of being a rock star had literally only just been invented, right? Only, you know, it's the Beatles. It was like sort of only been around for 3 or 4 years. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. The idea that anyone would not want that was inconceivable.
Yeah.
No, how do you tell anyone? Actually, no, thanks.
Would you like to win the pools? No, thank you.
Yeah.
But I suppose, in a way, was it encouraged because his lyrics were so out there and the thought that maybe he writes best on acid?
No. I don't think from the band's point of view. Because I don't... I wouldn't want to paint myself as the world's great expert on Sid. I've no idea which songs were or weren't written.
What I find about those songs, which is kind of odd, is that they're sort of they're quite ramshackle at times. I mean, when we were doing, say, Vegetable Man Bike, for example, you know, that sometimes it's always a 3-4 bar here, isn't it? Or it's a 3.5 bar.
Yeah, no, but it isn't. It's just it's because he's not thinking about that. He's writing purely from the vocal. And so to him, as long as he has, you know, you have a line that's vaguely similar, that's similar enough to be in the same song. And that's the way George Harrison writes like that sometimes, where you're not really thinking about time. He's not thinking about the band. You're just not thinking about the band. It's just, and there's a lot of old...
stream of consciousness, really.
Yeah, but it's also a way... I remember David once showed me this brilliant thing of how, with old blues singers, how if there isn't a band, your time constraints are completely different. It's only when you have to start thinking about other people that you really have to worry about being in time or being of a certain
But
age.
It's funny enough, because out of all of the Floyd stuff that we do, Sid's stuff is the stuff we follow to the beat.
To the absolute... Well, we have to, because we're both singing it. And it's the thing I've said before, what's incredibly impressive about Nick is the fact that we have to work our asses off just to be on top of this. You sail through it like it's the most straightforward, kind of like it's Take Me Home Country Road.
Well, it's in his DNA, isn't it? It probably says early, you know, Sid Barrett, but if you cut you open, in a way, is that sort of... That's part of how you started off as a musician, listening to him.
I guess so. I mean, it's one of those... curious things that you don't really think about. There is this mixture when we're on stage, you know, between, let's say, Arnold Lane, which is very specifically, as you say, played to the record and follows the process completely.
Yeah.
And we got another drummer next, and one who worked and hung out a lot with Sid. He was born to drum. His father was the drummer in a jazz band, and he was in his own band, the Valkyries, aged 11.
This clip of Jerry Shirley that we're going to play talks about him knowing Sid Barrett when he was a younger man and going off to clubs with him, the speakeasy, and playing drums at the age of 14 with Steve Marriott. It was a really fun episode, and he's actually got a great book out, which is worth looking at for any of you bibliophiles, called The Best Seat in the House, which is a great title for any drummer, I think.
It is. And I thought it was very, very poignant that way he talked about Sid, saying he only knew him after the fire.
Wow. Here he is, Jerry Shirley.
I didn't know him before the fire, if you like. You know, I knew him after the fire. And
That's a sweet way of putting it.
Well, it's a fact. And so I would get glimpses of the old Sid, except they would happen in strange ways. As an example, he was my going to the speakeasy buddy, except Sid's way of going to the speakeasy, all dressed to kill, you know, looking cool, because Sid still looked cool then, you know, in 1971, except his eyes had gotten to that sort of dark, you know, what's the line from the song, the dark holes in the whatever, but he still, you know, was dressed good. He was Sid Barrett, you know, he had presence. So he'd turn up at me and Willie's flat on Redcliffe Gardens, ready to go to the speakeasy, except it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Oh, okay, Sid, well, come in.
What time did it open?
11 o'clock. Yeah. So I didn't start, the speak didn't start getting going until 11 and went until, I don't know, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 sometimes, I think.
But, so he'd lost track of time completely at that
Well,
point.
Yeah, I mean, so we would say, okay, come on in, you know, and then we would do what, you know, 1970 hippies would do. We'd sit around all day, you know, rolling joints, smoking tea, listening to music, and he'd be perfectly normal. He never had any money on him, ever. Never, you know, so we'd drive him to the speakeasy, and I think because he was with us or because I'd started to become known at that point a little bit, I'm not sure, we were let in for nothing, so we didn't have to worry about paying to get in. But once we were in there, we bought him his drink, something. But the main thing was that he would be perfectly normal going there. But as soon as he went in, and bearing in mind it was his idea to go, he just shut off. As soon as he walked in, as soon as he was faced wow. with people, with the business, you know, with the place he wanted to go to, that was it. He would just shut down. He was just staring into the middle distance. And you couldn't get a word out of him until such time as it was time to go. And we'd drive him home, and then 8 o'clock the next morning. My best experience there that kept my feet firmly on the ground was with Ginger Baker years before, when I was, I think I must have been about 15 at the time. I was doing sessions for Immediate Records, well, for Steve Marriott. I'd had a lot of compliments while I was doing these sessions by Steve. He used to show me off to all these big shot friends of his. Right, I'd be doing a drum check.
You're a few years younger than everyone.
Yeah, at this point, I'm talking about 66, 67. I was 14, 15. And everybody that Steve's showing me off to, the people like Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts and Jimi Hendrix were all in their 20s already, late 20s, some maybe. Mm-mm. But they were all very, very sweet to me, you know, and I was very shy. He'd do the same thing every time. I'd be doing a drum check with Vin Johns or Eddie Kramer doing the sound. I'd have my head down, and of course, they were getting great drum sounds, but I was in Studio B. Anyway, so I'd have my head down and bang, glass, wallop, you know, and then they'd say, right, come listen. And I'd look up, and there'd be Steve Marriott, Mick Jagger, and Charlie Watts. That was a one time. And I just wanted the ground to swallow me up. I was so, yeah, I mean, 14, and there's your heroes, and I'm in back. And I'm not very tall now, but I was a lot shorter then. So anyway, I get off the drum kit and I walk towards him, and Charlie came over to me, put his arm around me, and he said, that's enough to make me want to cut my wrists off. And now, wow. he didn't have to say something like that, and it's not true, because he was just by far and away the greatest groove drummer. I mean, Charlie's backbeat was just, and his snare drum sound was the best in the business, always was, always will be. You know, may he rest in peace. And when Hendrix was the one, what he did was a similar thing. Because they could see I was just shy and nervous and stuff. And Hendrix said, well, man, he said, that's really cool. That's really cool. So I go to the speakeasy.
That's enough from Jimmy.
And the little band I was in at the time were playing, and we hadn't played very well. And I'm looking out at the bar, and there's Ginger Baker. So I thought, okie dokie. Now, I get off the stage, and you had to walk past to get to the dressing room. You had to walk past where he was to get there. So I'm walking along, trying, you know, keeping my head up. And as I get level with him, he's leaning very Ginger Baker-like against the bar. And as I walk past him, he looks at me and says, just, you know, just when my head's getting, you know, a little bit sort of, oh, I'm doing good here. And he looks straight at me and says, fucking shit.
God.
So Jeff, I thank him, may he rest in peace, for keeping my feet firmly on the ground.
Wow, wow. You said, I wasn't that tall then, and I'm a bit taller now. So you're not even grown up.
What now or then?
No, then. I mean, yeah, then you're still like a child growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was still going.
A massive Small Faces fan, weren't you, Jerry?
Yeah.
Did you have an incident where you bumped into Steve Marriott early on?
Yeah, that's how it all started. It all started by seeing them on Ready, Steady, Go, and I couldn't believe watching Kenny. It was like watching me. You know, he had the same drum kit. I just managed to save up enough money for a deposit on a silver glitter super classic Ludwig kit, which was what he had. And I didn't know he had. I'd never seen him before. Mm-hmm. And his playing style was exactly like mine. And, of course, because they were the sort of King Mods, we suddenly became even more moddy than we were already becoming. And we became like most bands did at the time, which was a Small Faces copy band.
Your name very much alluded to that, didn't it?
Yeah, at one point, yeah. When you mean when we were the little people?
The little people.
Yeah. that you can't get any more alluding to being a Small Faces copy band.
Right.
Anyway, we played a gig supporting them, and my dad was helping the guy promote the show, I think, and he went into their dressing room and very politely, my dad was just the greatest. He, you know, it was him that got me started. But anyway, he went in and introduced himself and just said, would you mind having a look at my son? He was playing in the band for you because he's a huge fan of yours and it would mean a lot to me and it would be a lot to him. And so I don't know this is going on. And I'm on stage playing and we're doing all the Tamla Motown hits. We had to take our Small Faces jackets off. You know, we couldn't support them and be looking like them something. I turn to the left and I look in the wings and there's Kenny Jones going like this.
Thumbs up.
Now, wow. Now, at this point, I was just turned 14, I think. Then, minutes later, I look again, and there's him and Steve Marriott both going like this. So after the show, they came up to me and said, that was fantastic. You're really doing great. And jokingly, well, I didn't know, and I went away thinking it might one day happen, but jokingly said, if Kenny ever gets sick, you could be standing. And I went, oh, wow, you know. So I'm getting all this tapping on the back. And again, I thank Ginger Baper for keeping me on the ground. But that's how we first met him. Then we met Steve on Shaftesbury Avenue. He was in Drum City looking at something, and we were just looking in the shop window and saw him in there and just went in and reintroduced ourselves. I think it was our keyboard player said to him, don't suppose you could record a single for us, could you? You know, he was one of those guys, you know.
I bet Steve looked immaculate. I'm trying to picture this as well.
Steve at this point is the best dressed guy in the world. He's just, in fact, I can remember literally what he was wearing that day. He had this fabulous, it was a typical kind of mod style jacket, and then he had a waistcoat that was made of the same material, but it was double-breasted, kind of like a Western cowboy type of waistcoat, with a white shirt, black mohair strides, beautifully cut, and a pair of white pumps, sneakers. And he just, not only did he look $1 million, you know, his hair was just cool. And he smelled like $1 million. You know, because they all were really into being immaculate in the way that they dressed, until the 67-ish, when they turned into hippies, that's when all that kind of went in They still dressed well, but it wasn't quite as immaculate, shall we say.
So next we have Shel Talmy, who was one of the most incredible producers of the 60s in London. I mean, he sort of pretty much invented the rock sound, didn't he?
Well, he did. I mean, well, he did that riff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Kinks' early singles, you know, with that first distorted guitar, You Really Got Me, with the amp being slashed. And and of course, he worked with The Who, and he produced their first album, My Generation.
Yep, and of course, the legendary Can't Explain and other things.
He worked with Jimmy Page as a session player as well. I mean, he was...
Jimmy was what he kept in his back pocket, wasn't he? He basically used to bring Jimmy along to pretty much every session he did.
Yeah. So let's get him on. Shel Talmy. Shel, absolute privilege to have you on. You created, really, for us guys, the sound of British pop music.
Well, thank you for that. I'm not sure that's totally accurate, but I certainly did my best coming from L.A., where, you know, I think you know I started out as a recording engineer. And I spent a lot of time at the studio figuring out how to mic various instruments, how to isolate them and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I actually brought with me to London when I went. And it looks like it paid off, which is nice.
Well, you were the first person to use tons of microphones on the drums.
Yes. Yeah, I always wanted control of every piece of drum equipment. And at that point in time, both there and here, everybody was using like three or four mics. And I thought that's really not good enough. So I worked out how to use 12 without them phasing, which is what the first thing I was told when I brought it to London was that you can't do that because all the mics will phase. I said, well, I guess you just have to listen. So, you know, a month later, everybody was trying to use 12 mics.
But it's true what Guy says. I mean, your drum sound, you know, on people like Keith Moon was incredible. I mean, you look at a track by The Creation, like, how does it feel?
Yeah.
I mean, that drum kit, I mean, Jimmy Page could only have dreamt of that later on. No drums had ever sounded like this before.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that because I was always very intent on getting the best possible sounds I could get. And if I succeeded, then I'm extremely pleased.
These were tiny desks back then, right? We're talking about sort of three, if you were lucky, four-track machines.
Comparatively speaking, yeah, sure.
I don't want to get too technical for our listeners, but just having enough the channels to put all those mics in must have been a challenge.
The studio I was in had a method of chaining another bunch of inputs. So that, you know, we're able to get all that together.
Right.
What was the beginning for you, Shel, getting into being an engineer? What encouraged you to do that? Were you a musician? Because I know you've written some songs.
No, I'm not. I play guitar, but I'm a good enough producer not to ever want to record myself as a guitarist. I guess it goes back to when I was 13. And I think it's fair to say a smart-ass kid in school. And a teacher sent in...
Sorry, if I can stop you there. You were appearing on a quiz show when you were a kid, right?
Yes, it was called The Quiz Kids, right. And I loved the whole idea of it, but even then I wanted to be behind the camera instead of in front of it. But that was the turning point for me in terms of selecting showbiz as a career.
Because just to follow up on that, you've got one of this incredible high IQ, haven't you, Shel? You're part of a group of people above the 99.9 percentile of the rest of the human race.
They're called the 999 Society. And it is a high IQ organization. And I find it extremely interesting to be part of it. And the members are all separated truly around the world. So very seldom do we ever get together and meet each other. It's all usually by either email or, I guess, Zoom now, although I haven't done that yet.
Are you sort of like the Avengers? Do you sort of look down on the rest of we poor humans?
I have never looked down on anybody who did not deserve to have to be looked down upon.
So there's a story about you coming to England with a load of records of acetates that you didn't actually produce and being told, is that true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, it was only two acetates. My friend Nick Vinay was A&R at Capitol Records, and I told them I was going for 5 weeks, which was my intention, to London so I could see some of that and some of Paris before life passed me by. And I said, be nice if I could work for a couple of weeks. So they didn't have a whole lot of money. And he said, here, take my acetates and tell them you did them.
One of those was the Beach Boys, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's a
Beach
big
Boys, yeah.
Record.
Yes, Surf and Safari by the Beach Boys and Lou Rawls, the name of which now escapes me. But anyway, two great records. And when I met with Dick Rowe at the Decca, after hearing him, he said, you start today. So
we have to talk about the Kinks, because this is your first sort of major record. But and there's so much myth and legend that surrounds that first single, You Really Got Me, and especially in the guitar sound. But was this a band that was presented to you, or did you go and see them live? And what were they like?
No, I was actually in Denmark Street visiting some publisher friends of mine. We were going to have lunch. And
Tin Pan Alley, as it was known.
Yes, Tin Pan Alley, right.
Yeah.
And Robert Wace, one of the managers, walked in with an acetate of the Kinks. And I was in the lobby, and he said, anybody here would like to listen to this? And I said, well, I'm here, I'll listen. So I did. And liked a lot about what I heard. And eventually I took them into Pi and got them signed.
I understand You Really Got Me was a very different version, because Ray wrote it on the piano, didn't he?
He wrote most everything on the piano, yeah. At least originally, I think he did switch off from time to time, but he wrote stuff at home. So I wasn't privy to how he went about it, but mainly piano, I think, is what he used.
But what's interesting is that for someone who's known for this incredible catalogue of fabulously whimsical sort of pastoral songwriting, that he basically invented heavy rock as we know it with this sort of little batch of songs.
I don't think he started out thinking that way, or did I? The fact that it turned out that way was, I think, a surprise for all of us. And the fact that it's continued to last is also a very nice surprise.
So do you think much of that could have been to do with you, Shell, knowingly or unknowingly?
I got to figure that I had a damn good part of it. I mean, yes, I was the producer. I was a hands-on producer. I had worked out how to do drums and lots of other sounds, including guitars. And so I guess, I'm as responsible as Ray is for writing a great song.
But I guess that's guitar sound, which is seminal now. You know, the Dave Davis guitar sound, which, you know, the fifths. You know, you can follow the seam that goes on from there through punk and through all kinds of heavy rock and Oasis, 90s, whatever.
Well, the torn speakers, wasn't it? That was the thing.
Sound, we are told, through myth, it was where the speakers were slashed.
Yeah.
Were you in the room when those speakers got slashed? And tell me the truth. What is the real story?
It was, I think it was called an El Pico amp. And not only was it slashed, but David definitely suggested that as we walk by, we could give it a kick or two. So it developed its own sound. And I did chain it to an AC-30.
Ah. And, you like your chaining, don't you?
And yes. Well, if it works, yeah. It, you know,
was that the first distorted guitar sound on record? Can we just have that as a definitive yes or no? Or?
You know, a lot of people say it is. I can't comment one way or the other. I don't know. It's certainly among the first, let's put it that way.
And of course, there's the question of the other musicians who were there.
The other musicians who also were terrific, yes. Yeah.
We know he didn't do the solo. We know he didn't do the solo. We know that. We're not going to ask
Jimmy
that
Page we're talking about.
Page
right?
finally admitted that he didn't do the solo. Why he even said he never did, I've never understood. In fact, he wasn't even on that session. So I employed him for the album because Ray wanted to concentrate on singing and not playing rhythm guitar. So I employed him as a rhythm guitarist for the album.
Okay, we're just going to hold there for a second, because I think, you know, you are the touchstone here. You know, you've got Ray Davis and Jimmy Page in the room. No one knows who Jimmy Page is really outside of the studio world. What was Jimmy like as the session player?
Oh, Jimmy was great. No, I found him when he was about 17, and he didn't read music then. So, I mean, my early memories of him when I booked him on sessions was in between takes, he was practicing how to read music. So, he's an extraordinary guitarist, no question.
Do you know what? I had a funny thing. I worked with Jimmy many times over years, but I did a project with him with David Coverdale. And when we were rehearsing for the shows, we did all these Zeppelin songs and all their songs. And then there was going to be a load of Whitesnake stuff. And I remember thinking, how the hell is Jimmy going to learn all this stuff? And of course he had it in a second, because of course he's the session dog, and it was, you know, it's like, and it's never leaves you.
Yeah, he was very quick.
Just while we're on Jimmy, and I know we'll come back to Jimmy later when we talk about The Who, everyone thinks that Jimmy was the first guy to pick up a bow and to bow the guitar, but actually it was Eddie Phillips, no, right?
That's Eddie Phillips, absolutely.
From The Creation. Yeah,
and Jimmy... No, I won't use the word stole. Let's say borrowed. And he started using it.
All artists steal, don't they? Don't they say average artists borrow, great artists steal?
Yes, of course, of course. But was Jimmy in the room when Eddie Phillips from The Creation was bowing away one day? And when?
No, he wasn't on those sessions at all.
All right. They're great records, by the way, The Creation. I know that comes up a little bit later. But I mean, Making Time and Painter Man, I mean, they're just... I mean, as Guy was saying to me earlier, you know, this is the 90s. Oasis wouldn't have existed, would they, Guy?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But in fact, you know, Alan McGee named his label after them.
They were one of my very favorite bands. And my major regret is that right after I made a deal with Ahmet Erdogan at Atlantic to sign them for Atlantic, to make them the superstars they deserve to be, they broke up and I could not keep them together.
Wow.
Well, thank you for listening. And next week, we're going to be coming onto certainly Gary's home turf.
Yeah, some 80s icons. And how are you enjoying our little holiday, Guy?
I'm absolutely loving it, Gary. I particularly enjoyed What the Butler Saw this afternoon on the pier.
Yes.
But
yes,
aren't you still a bit dizzy from the waltzer?
Yes, but Mrs. Branston's tea room certainly calmed me down.
Yeah, that lemon drizzle cake hits the spot every time, doesn't it?
It did. And I guess this evening we'll go for a little stroll along the pier, maybe.
Promenade on the greensward.
Thank you for listening. As we said, we are trying to give you episodes, deliver these best ofs and some of ourselves while we are on this holiday and preparing ourselves for our Australian trip. And as we say, next week it will be 80s heroes? What are we calling it?
80s icons. 80s icons.
Gal. Icons. 80s icons. I wonder if my brother's going to be in it. Certainly. We'll see you there. Thank you for listening. And it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.